On July 16, 1860, 3 weeks after three-year-old Frances Saville Kent's body was discovered in the outdoor privy of Roadhill House, a train departed Paddington Station, bound for Wiltshire. The passenger looked unremarkable enough, middle-aged, smallpox-scarred face, blue eyes that catalogued every detail, a single leather bag, a notebook thick with information about the Kent family, their house, and the local police investigation that had accomplished exactly nothing. Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher, about to solve England's most notorious murder case. The Great Western Railway carried Witcher southwest through England's industrial heart. Coal smoke from the locomotive drifted past his window. 3 hours to Towbridge, through countryside turning steadily greener. The soot and brick of London giving way to Wiltshire farmland. Rain had plagued England all summer. Storm after storm rolling across the West Country, turning roads to rivers of mud. When Witcher stepped off at Towbridge Station that July afternoon, water dripped from the platform overhang. A horse-drawn carriage waited. 6 miles to the village of Road, through lanes so narrow, the hedgerows scraped both sides. The driver knew his passenger's destination without being told. Everyone in Wiltshire knew about Roadhill House. The house appeared through the rain. 3 stories of brick and stone set back from the road, behind high walls and an iron gate. Windows flickered with lamplight despite the afternoon hour. The storm had turned the day dark. The smell of tallow candles mixed with damp earth. Witcher cataloged everything. Locked gate requiring announcement before entry. Isolation from the village. Clear sight lines from upper windows. Servants' wings separate from family quarters. A fortress with secrets inside. Witcher had spent 20 years as a detective. He was one of 8 men who founded Scotland Yard's detective branch in 1842, back when plainclothes police officers investigating crimes was considered radical and ungentlemanly. His colleagues called him the Prince of Detectives. He had solved murders that baffled everyone else. Photographic memory, instinct for human psychology that bordered on supernatural. He was also a gardener's son, working class, merit over bloodline, in a society that valued the opposite. That would matter more than anyone realized. Samuel Kent, the father, met Witcher at the door. Kent was a factory inspector, middle class, respectable, with the bearing of a man accustomed to authority. But Witcher saw through the performance. Kent's eyes were exhausted. His hands shook slightly when he gestured toward the house. This was a man holding himself together through sheer Victorian self-discipline. Witcher had read the reports from the local police. They believed an outsider had broken into Roadhill House, murdered Francis in his crib, then escaped with the child's body to the outdoor privy, where the corpse was discovered the next morning. The open window in the drawing room, the muddy footprints, the missing kitchen knife. It took Witcher less than an hour to determine the local police were completely wrong. The window had been opened from the inside. The dust on the sill was undisturbed on the outside. The muddy footprints came from boots stored inside the house. The child's body showed no signs of being carried through the rain and mud. He had been murdered indoors. The throat wound was precise, deliberate, done by someone who knew exactly where to cut. This wasn't a random intruder. This was an inside job, and that meant Witcher was looking for someone who lived in Roadhill House. Someone who had walked through those corridors at night. Someone who knew where Francis slept, where the knives were kept, and where a small body could be hidden. Someone the family would never suspect. Witcher opened his notebook and began his investigation the same way he always did, by watching everyone very carefully and writing down everything they said. In 5 days, he would identify the killer, and it would destroy his career. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. This is the story of Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher, one of England's first professional detectives, and how being right about a murder case cost him everything.
Jonathan Witcher represented something new in Victorian England, the professional detective. When he arrived at Roadhill House on July the 16th, 1860, he brought methods that would seem familiar to modern investigators, but were considered radical, even ungentlemanly in his era. He had no fingerprints to analyse, no DNA, no blood typing, no forensic laboratory waiting in London to process evidence. What Witcher had was his methodical observation and an understanding of human psychology that was decades ahead of his time. The local constabulary had already contaminated the crime scene. They had moved the body multiple times, allowed family members and neighbours to walk through the outdoor privy where Francis's corpse was discovered, lost crucial evidence in their eagerness to point fingers at an imaginary outside intruder. Witcher started over from the beginning. He examined the outdoor privy in daylight, measuring distances and angles. The privy stood about 30 yards from the house, down a gravel path that would have been allowed to cross at night. Francis's body had been found inside, carefully placed on the seat, with his blanket arranged around him. Not thrown, not discarded, arranged. That told Witcher something important about the killer's state of mind. He studied the house itself, 3 floors, multiple staircases. Servants used the narrow back stairs, family the broad front. Numerous bedrooms. The nursery where Francis slept was on the 2nd floor, watched over by Elizabeth Gough, the children's nurse. His wooden rocking horse still stood by the window where he'd ridden it each morning, calling himself a soldier. Constant Kent's bedroom was 1 floor up on the 3rd floor. The parents, Samuel and Mary Kent, slept in their own bedroom on the 2nd floor. Victorian houses like Roadhill House operated on strict hierarchies. Servants slept in the attic or the basement. Family members occupied the middle floors. Visitors, like Witcher himself, received specific rooms in the guest quarters. Everyone knew their place. Witcher began his interviews. He spoke with the servants first, the cook, the housemaid, the laundress, the gardener. In Victorian society, servants were often invisible to their employers, present but not really seen. That made them excellent observers. They noticed things wealthy families preferred to ignore. Sarah Cox, the housemaid, told Witcher something that caught his attention. In the days after the murder, when the house should have been in chaos, Constance Kent had been calm. Too calm. She showed no signs of grief over her half-brother's death. No tears. No visible emotion. Normal 16-year-old girls didn't react that way when their little brother, who'd called them Tanny, and followed them around the house begging for stories, was found with his throat slashed. Witcher interviewed Elizabeth Gough, the nursemaid, multiple times. Her story had inconsistencies. She claimed she checked on Francis during the night and found him sleeping peacefully. But the next morning, the nursery door was unlocked when it was usually bolted from inside. Francis's crib was empty. The window was open despite the cold rain. Gough says she immediately searched the house, didn't wake the parents, didn't alarm the other servants. spent what she claimed was 30 minutes looking for a missing child before raising the alarm. Witcher didn't believe her initial story, but he also didn't think Gough had murdered Frances. Her behaviour suggested she was hiding something, perhaps knowledge after the fact, but not that she had wielded the knife. Witcher's technique was revolutionary for 1860. He interviewed everyone separately, then compared their stories for discrepancies. He asked the same questions multiple ways to see if their answers changed. He observed body language, tone of voice, nervous gestures. He built psychological profiles based on behavioural patterns. Modern detectives would recognise every technique. Victorian society found it invasive and disturbing. The constabulary had focused on finding an outside intruder because that's what respectable families believed. Murder came from outside, from the lower classes, from criminals, from strangers. It didn't come from within well-to-do households where everyone knew everyone and social rules governed every interaction. Witcher knew better. His 20 years of detective work had taught him that murder was usually personal. Killers were most often family members or close acquaintances. Crimes of passion happened behind closed doors, not in dramatic break-ins. He began building a timeline of the night Frances died. Frances went to bed around 8 o'clock on June the 29th, 1860. His mother had kissed him goodnight. Elizabeth Gough settled him in his crib. The house locked up for the night. Victorian households secured themselves against the outside world. Bolted doors, latched windows, servants dismissed to their quarters. Sometime between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m, someone entered the nursery. Someone who knew the house well enough to move in darkness. Someone strong enough to carry a sleeping child. Someone with access to the kitchen knives. Someone familiar with the outdoor privy's location. Someone who lived in Road Hill House. Witcher started focusing on the family itself, and that's when he discovered the missing nightgown.
The discovery came from the laundry. Victorian households ran on schedules, as precise as clockwork. Washing day happened weekly, Monday usually, and every garment was counted, sorted, washed, dried, and returned to its proper owner. Respectable families kept laundry books, where everything was recorded. Sheets, pillowcases, undergarments, nightdresses, all documented. Sarah Cox, the housemaid, had mentioned something to Witcher during their interview. Something about Constance's nightgowns. Witcher followed up with the laundress, Miss Esther Hawley. Miss Hawley kept meticulous records. She knew exactly how many nightgowns each member of the Kent family owned. Mary Kent, the stepmother, had 4. The older daughters had 3 each. Constance Kent had 3. After the murder, when the house laundry was collected and counted, only 2 of Constance's nightgowns could be found. One of the nightgowns was missing. Witcher understood immediately. In 1860, before modern forensics, absence of evidence could be evidence itself. The missing nightgown told a story. Victorian nightdresses were long, white garments made of cotton or linen. They covered a woman from neck to ankle. If someone wearing a nightdress had committed a murder involving blood, and Frances Saville Kent's murder involved massive blood loss from the nearly severed throat, that nightdress would have been soaked. Impossible to clean. Impossible to explain. Easier to destroy it completely. Witcher built his theory. Constance Kent wore one of her nightgowns on the night of June 29th, 1860. She entered the nursery, took Francis from his crib, carried him downstairs and outside to the privy. There, she murdered him. The nightgown would have been covered in blood. She couldn't wash it, too much blood, too obvious. She couldn't hide it in her room. Servants would find it during cleaning. She couldn't leave it in the laundry. Miss Holly would spot the blood immediately. So, she destroyed it. Burned it, probably, in one of the house's fireplaces. Or buried it somewhere on the grounds. Or threw it into the privy itself, letting it sink into the waste below. Then, she manipulated the laundry count, placed her remaining two nightgowns into the wash basket, waited for laundry day. When Miss Holly asked about the missing third nightgown, Constance could claim the laundress had lost it. But Witcher knew Victorian laundresses didn't lose garments. Their livelihoods depended on meticulous counting and care. The nightgown wasn't the only physical evidence that had been mishandled. On July 1st, the day after the murder, a local policeman named Alfred Urch had been searching the property. He reached into the boiler hole near the privy, basically a small coal furnace used to... Hello, friend. I need to tell you about a book that had me completely locked in. It's called Run on Red by Noel W. Eiley. Picture this, a dark, empty highway through the Idaho hills. No cell signal for miles. Two women realize the headlights behind them aren't going away. What starts as road rage turns into something far worse. A brutal, heart-pounding fight for survival that doesn't let up for a single page. Laura and Olivia can't outrun what's coming, so they have to fight back. And this book does what the best thrillers do. It takes an ordinary situation and makes you realize how fast it can go sideways. I burned through it. Every chapter drops you off a cliff. If you're into Freda McFadden or Karen Slaughter, this is your next read. Run on Red is now available as a deluxe special edition with gorgeous stenciled edges, as beautiful on the shelf as it is terrifying in your hands. Out February 24th. Grab it while you can. Heat water for the house. Inside, he found a bloodied woman's undergarment. A shift. Urch showed it to his supervising officer, who looked at the blood and assumed it was menstrual. Victorian men were so uncomfortable with women's bodies that the officer told Urch to throw the garment back into the boiler hole and forget about it. When Witcher arrived 16 days later and asked about physical evidence, no one mentioned the bloody shift. It had vanished, probably burned in the boiler or stolen by someone who realized its significance. This was the kind of incompetence that made Witcher's job nearly impossible. The local constabulary had contaminated the crime scene, moved the body, lost crucial evidence, pursued absurd theories about outside intruders. 16 days wasted before calling in Scotland Yard. Witcher worked with what he had, the missing nightgown. He interviewed Constance Kent directly. 16 years old, tall for her age, dark hair pulled back into the period style. Witnesses described a strong mind. During the interview, she didn't cry, didn't show emotion, answered his questions calmly and directly. Yes, she owned three nightgowns. No, she didn't know where the missing one had gone. Perhaps the laundress had made a mistake. Perhaps it had been mislaid during the chaos after Francis's murder. Her composure was remarkable. Most 16-year-old girls questioned by a detective about their murdered brother would have been terrified. Constance showed no fear. Witcher noted that in his book. He learned more about Constance's history. The family dynamics at Roadhill House were complex and toxic. Samuel Kent's first wife, Constance's mother, had died in 1852 after bearing 10 children and suffering from what Victorians called mental affliction. Samuel had married the family's governess, Mary Drew Pratt, just 15 months later. The speed of that remarriage had created scandal. Whispers that Samuel and Mary had been conducting an affair while the first Miss Kent was still alive. Whispers that Constance and her siblings from the first marriage were being neglected in favor of Mary's children, including Francis. In 1857, when Constance was 13 and her brother William was 11, they had attempted to run away together. They disguised themselves, packed bags, and tried to reach Bristol to board a ship. They were caught and brought home, where, according to some accounts, Constance was punished severely. That runaway attempt was significant to Whicher for one reason. During their escape, Constance and William had hidden some of their supplies in the outdoor privy, the same privy where Francis's body would be discovered 3 years later. Constance knew that privy well. She knew how to access it at night. She knew it was far enough from the house that sounds might not be heard. She knew its layout and how a small body could be concealed there temporarily. Whicher began building his circumstantial case. Motive, resentment toward the second family that had displaced her. Opportunity, she lived in the house and knew its routines. Means, she was physically capable of carrying a sleeping child and using a knife. Evidence, the missing nightgown that should have existed but didn't. By July 19th, 5 days after his arrival, Whicher was convinced. Constance Kent had murdered her half-brother, Francis. The magistrates would be harder to convince than he'd been.
By July the 19th, 1860, Jonathan Whicher had assembled his case against Constance Kent. It was circumstantial, built on the absence of a nightgown, suspicious behaviour, psychological profile, and opportunity. Victorian juries convicted people on circumstantial evidence regularly. Whicher knew his case was solid. But there was a problem. Constance wasn't a servant or someone from the lower classes. She was the daughter of a factory inspector, a young lady from a respectable family, and Whicher was a gardener's son who had risen to detective through merit rather than birth. Class would matter. Whicher presented his findings to the local magistrate in Trowbridge. They listened to his evidence, the missing nightgown documented by the laundress, Constance's lack of emotion after her brother's murder, her physical capability and knowledge of the house, the motive of resentment towards the second family. The magistrates were sceptical. A 16-year-old girl murdering her toddler half-brother? It seemed impossible, unnatural, against every Victorian assumption about female delicacy and family bonds. But Whicher was convincing. He had solved cases that baffled others. He was Scotland Yard's best detective. If he believed Constance Kent was guilty, that carried weight. The magistrate agreed to an arrest, with conditions. They gave Whicher 7 days to prepare his case. 7 days from Constance's arrest to a preliminary hearing, where he would have to present enough evidence to hold her for trial. If he couldn't meet that burden within 7 days, she would be released. It was an impossible timeline. Modern murder investigations take months, sometimes years. Whicher had already spent 5 days investigating. Now he had seven more to build a case strong enough to overcome Victorian society's disbelief that a respectable young woman could commit such violence. But he had no choice. The murder of Frances Saville Kent had become a national scandal. Newspapers across England were demanding answers. The government wanted the case solved. If Witcher believed he knew the killer, he had to act. On July the 20th, 1860, he returned to Road Hill House to make the arrest. Witcher understood the risks. He was about to accuse the daughter of a middle-class family of murdering her own brother. He had no confession, no weapon with blood evidence, no witness who saw the crime, no physical proof beyond the absence of a nightgown. What he had was his detective instinct, 20 years of experience, and the courage to follow evidence even when it led somewhere Victorian society didn't want to go. The evidence pointed to Constance Kent. The motive was clear: resentment, jealousy, rage at being displaced by the second family. The opportunity was undeniable. She lived in the house, knew its routines, had used that privy before. The missing nightgown suggested conscience of guilt. Witcher was right. He knew he was right. But being right wasn't going to be enough. Victorian England was about to teach Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher that truth and justice don't always align. That sometimes solving the crime is the easy part. That a working-class detective could be destroyed for daring to accuse a young lady of breeding, regardless of what the evidence showed. The arrest would take 5 minutes. The consequences would last the rest of his life.
Friday morning, July 20th, 1860. Witcher arrived at Road Hill House, accompanied by the local constabulary. Samuel Kent received them in the entrance hall. The house was quiet. Most of the family was at breakfast. Witcher requested to see Constance privately. Kent led him upstairs, to the third floor, to Constance's bedroom. This was highly irregular. Victorian propriety dictated that a male detective should not interview a young unmarried woman alone in her bedroom. But Witcher was about to arrest her for murder. Propriety was about to become the least of anyone's concerns. Constance Kent sat by her window. 16 years old, dark hair pinned up in the Victorian style, wearing a day dress. She had been reading when they entered. She looked up at Witcher with calm, composed features. He saw no surprise in her eyes, almost as if she had been expecting this. Witcher spoke formally, using the exact words required by English law. "Constance Kent, I am a police officer from Scotland Yard. I have here a warrant for your arrest on suspicion of the murder of Francis Saville Kent on the night of June 29th, 1860. He showed her the warrant, official paper with a magistrate's seal. Constance's composure finally broke. Tears began streaming down her face. Her hand shook. She stood from her chair, and for the first time since her brother's murder, she showed genuine emotion. "I am innocent," she said. Her voice was barely a whisper, but Witcher heard every word. "I have done nothing wrong. I loved my brother. I would never, could never, hurt Francis." She began to sob, deep, wrenching cries that echoed Victorian feminine distress. Samuel Kent stood in the doorway, frozen between supporting his daughter and submitting to legal authority. Mary Kent appeared behind him, her face white with shock. Witcher had arrested murderers before. He had seen every kind of reaction: rage, terror, denial, acceptance. He had learned to read people, to separate genuine emotion from performed innocence. Watching Constance Kent cry, he believed she was performing. He also noted her words, "I loved my brother," not "I love Francis," past tense, as if she had already processed his death and moved beyond it. A constable brought handcuffs, but Witcher waved them away. Constance was 16, small-framed, accompanied by multiple officers, she wasn't going to run. Victorian society had enough problems with a working-class detective arresting a young lady. Parading her through the village in iron restraints would make things worse. They brought her downstairs. Servants watched from doorways. The cook was crying. Sarah Cox, the housemaid, who had told Witcher about Constance's calm demeanor after Francis's death, stared at the girl with unreadable expression. A police carriage waited outside. The rain had stopped, but the July morning remained gray and cold. Witcher helped Constance into the carriage with proper Victorian curtsy. She was his prisoner, but she was also a young woman who, if he was wrong, was being subjected to the worst experience of her life. If he was wrong, he would have destroyed an innocent girl's reputation forever. But he wasn't wrong. He knew that. The journey to Devizes Jail took about an hour. 16 miles through Wiltshire countryside, past villages where people stopped to watch the police carriage pass. By afternoon, word would spread throughout the county. Detective Inspector from Scotland Yard had arrested Constance Kent for her brother's murder. Constance sat across from Witcher in the carriage, silent now. The tears had stopped. Her face had returned to that calm, composed mask she had worn during their interview. She stared out the window at the passing countryside. Witcher tried one more time. "Miss Kent, if you have anything to say, anything that might explain what had happened that night, now would be the time, before we reach the magistrate, before this becomes official." She looked at him directly. Her eyes were dry now. Her voice was steady. "I have nothing to say, Inspector, because I have done nothing wrong." They reached Devizes Jail late morning. Victorian prisons were grim places. Stone walls, iron bars, cells lit only by narrow windows. Constance would spend the next 7 days here, separated from her family, waiting for the preliminary hearing that would determine where she stood trial for murder. Witcher watched her being led away by the female warder. She walked with her back straight, her head high. Whatever was happening inside Constance Kent's mind, she wasn't going to show it. For 5 days, he had investigated the murder of Francis Saville Kent. He had examined the crime scene, interviewed the family and servants, discovered the missing nightgown, built his psychological profile. He had done everything right, according to detective methodology. Now came the hardest part, convincing Victorian England that a young lady of good breeding could murder her toddler half-brother in cold blood. Witcher left the prison and headed to Trowbridge to begin preparing for the hearing. He had 7 days. He would need every minute.
The newspapers exploded. By July the 21st, 1860, one day after Constance Kent's arrest, London papers were running stories about the case, not supporting Detective Inspector Witcher, savaging him. "Detective persecutes innocent girl," read one headline. "Scotland Yard overreach," declared another. "Working class brute accusing young lady of good family," summarised the prevailing sentiment. The coverage revealed everything wrong with Victorian England's class system. Witcher was a gardener's son who had risen to detective through competence and hard work. Constance Kent was a factory inspector's daughter, middle class, respectable, educated. By Victorian logic, his social origins made him suspect, while hers made her innocent. The press portrayed Witcher as a low-class intruder, meddling in affairs above his station. One editorial described him as vulgar, greedy, and rapacious. Language that had nothing to do with his detective work and everything to do with his working class origins. Multiple papers suggested that he was manufacturing evidence to advance his own career. The idea that a young lady would commit murder was unthinkable. Victorian gender ideology held that women, especially young, unmarried women of good breeding, were inherently delicate, pure, incapable of violence. Women fainted at the sight of blood. Women needed male protection. Women certainly didn't slash their toddler brothers' throats and arrange bodies in outdoor privies. Constance's tears during the arrest became proof of innocence. Her lack of confession became proof of purity. Her social class became armour against accusation. Public opinion turned viciously against Witcher. There was also an unspoken element to the outrage, sexual impropriety. Witcher had questioned Constance alone in her bedroom. A middle-aged man, unmarried, interviewing a 16-year-old girl in her private chambers. Victorian society found this almost as shocking as the murder accusation itself. The fact that he was arresting her for murder didn't matter. He had violated the sanctity of a young woman's bedroom. That alone made him suspect in Victorian eyes. Samuel Kent launched his own campaign. He hired an expensive barrister, Peter Edlin, Queen's Counsel from Bristol. Edlin was experienced, eloquent, and devastatingly effective in court. The Kent family had resources, and Samuel was using all of them to defend his daughter. Kent also used his government position. As a factory inspector, he had connections throughout Wiltshire's establishment. He spoke to magistrates, wrote letters to London officials, and made clear his opinion. Detective Inspector Witcher was persecuting his family. The local community rallied around the Kents. Road Village residents signed petitions supporting Constance. Fellow factory inspectors and middle-class families expressed outrage at Scotland Yard's tactics. The idea that a respected family could harbour a murderer seemed impossible. Even some women's advocates, the nascent Victorian feminist movement, defended Constance. They saw her as a victim of male authority overreach, a young woman being persecuted by police power. They used the case to argue that women were fundamentally different from men, incapable of such violence, deserving of protection from aggressive investigation. Charles Dickens was one of the few prominent figures who supported Witcher. Dickens had met the detective and featured him in his writing as Sergeant Witcham, in his magazine Household Words. Dickens understood that detectives like Witcher represented progress, professional investigation over class assumptions. But Dickens' support actually made things worse for Witcher. It reminded the public that Witcher was a working class hero to working class writers. It reinforced the class divide rather than bridging it. The magistrate hearing was scheduled for July the 27th, 7 days after the arrest, as required. Witcher spent that week building his case, gathering testimony, preparing to present the missing nightgown evidence, and the circumstantial web he had constructed. He knew the evidence was solid. He knew Constance Kent had murdered her brother. He knew he had done his job correctly. But he was beginning to understand that being right might not be enough. Victorian England had already decided. A young woman of breeding could not have committed such a crime. Therefore, Detective Inspector Witcher must be wrong. His evidence must be flawed. His methods must be improper. His accusations must be motivated by class resentment or career ambition. The truth didn't matter if it contradicted what society wanted to believe. Witcher's career would never recover from what was about to happen in that courtroom.
July 27th, 1860. The magistrate hearing began at Trowbridge Town Hall. The courtroom was packed. Local gentry, newspaper reporters from London, curious villagers who had followed every development of the case. Constance Kent sat in the dock wearing a black dress. her face pale but composed. 7 days in Devizes jail had not broken her. Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher took the stand to present his case. He laid out his evidence methodically. The missing nightgown documented by laundress Miss Esther Hawley. Constance's knowledge of the house and the outdoor privy from her 1857 runaway attempt. Her opportunity. She lived in the house, knew Francis's routine, could move through the building at night. Her motive, resentment toward the second family that had displaced her mother's children. Her psychological profile, a strong mind capable of planning and executing murder. It was circumstantial. Witcher acknowledged that directly. No confession, no weapon, no witness to the actual crime. But circumstantial cases convicted murderers regularly in Victorian England. Jurors understood that crimes committed in darkness rarely left perfect evidence. Then Peter Edlin stood to cross-examine. Edlin was everything Witcher was not. Educated at elite schools, eloquent in court, from respectable family origins. His voice filled the courtroom with authority of class and position. He dismantled Witcher's case piece by piece. The missing nightgown, the laundress had likely erred. Constance may have packed it away weeks before the murder and forgotten its location. Dozens of innocent explanations existed. The privy's location, anyone who lived at Roadhill House for years would know where it stood. Meaningless. Her composure after Francis's death. Women processed grief differently. Some wept openly. Others maintained dignified restraint. How dare this detective weaponize proper behavior as evidence of guilt? The supposed motive of murderous resentment? Pure speculation without foundation. Family testimony confirmed Constance had been kind to Francis, had played with him, had shown him sisterly affection. Edlin's voice grew louder, resonating with moral outrage. Scotland Yard had sent a working-class detective to persecute a 16-year-old girl from a respectable family. This man had questioned a young woman alone in her bedroom. Scandalous impropriety. And for what? Speculation? Circumstance? Not one shred of real evidence. The courtroom murmured in agreement. The magistrates themselves, from respectable middle-class backgrounds, listened carefully to Edlin's arguments. Witcher watched his case collapse. Not because his evidence was wrong, not because his detective work was flawed, because Victorian England could not accept what the evidence showed, that a gentleman's daughter had murdered her toddler half-brother. The magistrates consulted briefly. Insufficient evidence. Constance Kent was released immediately. The courtroom erupted. Supporters cheered. Constance began crying again. Tears of relief, this time. Samuel Kent embraced his daughter. Peter Edlin accepted congratulations, like a general accepting victory. Witcher stood alone at the prosecutor's table, collecting his notes. No one approached him. No one thanked him for his investigation. The local constabulary avoided his eyes. He had done his job perfectly, identified the killer through brilliant detective work, followed the evidence wherever it led, regardless of social consequences. He had lost. Constance Kent walked free from Trowbridge Town Hall on July 27, 1860. She returned to Roadhill House briefly. Then her father sent her away. First to the family's new home in Wiltshire, then to finishing school in France, eventually to St. Mary's Home Religious Convent in Brighton. The case of Francis Saville Kent's murder was declared unsolved. Local police closed the investigation. Scotland Yard withdrew from Wiltshire. Newspapers proclaimed justice had been served, the innocent girl freed from persecution. Witcher returned to London in disgrace. His superiors at Scotland Yard distanced themselves from the case. His reputation as England's greatest detective was shattered. Within a few years, forced into retirement. Health broken, career destroyed. The cruel irony, Witcher was right all along. Everything he said was true. His evidence solid, his logic sound, his detective work brilliant. But in 1860 Victorian England, being right meant nothing against class prejudice and social assumptions. A working class detective could not accuse an upper class young lady and survive, even when she was guilty. 5 years passed. Francis Saville Kent's murder became England's most notorious cold case. Newspapers occasionally revisited it, proposing theories about outside intruders or family conspiracies. No arrests, no confessions. Constance Kent lived at St. Mary's Home in Brighton, undergoing what appeared to be a profound religious transformation under the guidance of Father Arthur Wagner, an Anglo-Catholic priest who specialized in confession and ritual. The weight of Catholic-style confession, the constant emphasis on sin, guilt, and redemption, began working on her conscience. And in April 1865, Constance was about to do something that would shock England all over again. She was going to tell the truth. Until next time, remember, being right isn't always enough. Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher solved the Rothill House murder in 5 days through brilliant investigation, psychological profiling, and attention to a missing nightgown. But Victorian England wasn't ready to hear that a young lady of breeding could murder her toddler brother. Sometimes the truth is exactly what society refuses to believe, and the messenger pays the price for delivering it. Witcher lost his career, his reputation, his health, for the crime of being right too early. Next week on Foul Play, 5 years of silence, Constance Kent escaped justice in 1860. But she couldn't escape her own conscience. Under the weight of religious confession at St. Mary's Home in Brighton, the guilt finally becomes too heavy to carry. Thanks for listening, friend.